Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. In this audio, I will examine Genesis chapter 26, verses 1 through 22. I'm going to call this section, Isaac Lies to Abimelech of Gerar Concerning Rebekah. Our context is this. In chapter 25, after reading about Abraham's death and his descendants, at the end of the chapter, we read the famous story of how Esau sold his birthright to Jacob. And now we start in chapter 26, verse 1. Now there was a famine in the land besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. Now the now there, what time is being referred to? Well, some of the events of chapter 26, which we're about to go into, occurred before the birth of Jacob and Esau, which happened at the end of the last chapter. So we're not going in strict chronological order. And some of these events are being picked up at the earlier part of Isaac's life in order to show that Jacob was the rightful inheritor of Abraham's covenant blessing. So we see a little bit about Isaac's life so we can see that Jacob was legitimate too as far as the covenant promise. This is according to the NIV Study Bible. Now there was a famine in the land besides the previous famine that occurred in the days of Abraham. That's the famine that occurred in Genesis 12:10. Now there was a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. This was just right after Abram, he was called then, had arrived in Shechem in the promised land. He'd moved down to Hebron, and then the famine hit, and he goes to Egypt. Abraham also had gone to Gerar earlier too, not because of a famine, but just because he went there. Genesis 21, now Abraham journeyed from there, that means in Mamre near Hebron, the Oak of Mamre. He journeyed from Hebron, in other words, toward the land of the Negev, and settled between Kadesh and Shur, that's near Beer Haleroi. Then he sojourned in Gerar, and I'm sure he went to Gerar because Gerar was a very fruitful place, lots of animals could be pastured there. Now, all this was about 100 years before this particular famine. Now, since it was 100 years, this Abimelech, king of the Philistines, that's mentioned here in verse 1 of Genesis 26, is probably the son or the grandson of the previous Abimelech who received Abraham. Adam Clark says we can't know whether the two Abimelechs were the same. I don't think they were. That's 100 years later. It's most likely going to be at least a son, if not a grandson. And not only that, if it was the same Abimelech, it seems like he would be wise to this sister gambit that Abraham and Isaac are pulling on him. Abraham's already done it once, and so his son Isaac comes up there and says, oh, my wife's my sister. Well, Abraham had already done that, and Abimelech had already seen that and already gotten quite upset about it, so it seems like he would have been wise to Isaac if he had done it. So I'm going to assume this is a different Abimelech, which is a common name for the kings of Gerar, like Pharaoh was a common name for the kings of Egypt. It just means king. Now, where is this Gerar? Well, if you look at the map, you know where Gaza is on the southwestern coast, extremity of Israel on the coast of the Mediterranean. If you go 10 miles on a 45 degree southeast angle from Gaza, go about 10 miles, that's Gerar. Go another 20 miles, continuing on that straight 45 degree straight line, you end up at Beersheba. Gerar means a region or a lodging place. It seems to have been a rich pastoral country. This is coming from Easton's. Isaac there reaped a hundredfold and was blessed of God. Gerar might mean circle, or in addition to region, or its meaning might include circle as opposed to region. The statements, this is coming from BibleAtlas.org, from an H. Porter. The statements in Genesis indicate that Gerar belonged to the Philistines, and we are led to infer that Abimelech was king of that people. But it is quite certain that they did not occupy the region until after the time of Abraham. That's about 400 years later. Philistines didn't occupy the land of Gerar until only a short time before the Exodus, but they're going to be referred to as Philistines here in the text. How do you explain that? Well, Porter goes on to say, it is probable, however, that the writer of Genesis, that would be Moses, would refer to the country as it was known in his day. The town certainly existed in the Philistine period. Of course, his day is Moses' day, which, is, as I said, is 400 years later. The town certainly existed in the Philistine period, for it is mentioned in connection with Asa, who defeated the Ethiopian host under Zerar and pursued them in their flight unto Gerar. So, the mention of Abimelech, king of the Philistines, is anachronistic. Now, Isaac flees. He's living at Beer Haleroi, which was further to the southwest of Beersheba, and there's a famine there, but he goes, I don't know how many miles it is, it's not that many miles, 30, 40, 50 miles, He goes to Gerard. Just interesting that there's a famine in one place and plenty of food in another. That's because of weather patterns and also because there was no transportation back then except, I guess, ox carts. I don't know. Transportation was very poor, and so famine could be very regional. That has always been the problem with ancient agricultural economies. You can have plenty of crops in one place. They end up rotting in the field, and just a few hundred miles in another spot, people are dying of starvation. They don't have any food. No refrigerated cars and no transportation in general, much less refrigerated transportation. So anyway, Isaac went from Beer Lahairoy, as John Gill says. He had dwelt at Beer Lahairoy many years. Genesis 24:62 says this. Now Isaac had come from going to Beer Lahairoy, for he was living in the Negev. Now Beer Lahairoy, as I said, is to the southwest of Beersheba as you're going toward Egypt. The Wadi Al-Arish runs from north to south from the Mediterranean coast at a town called Al-Arish, which is still there today. And that Wadi Al-Arish is the boundary line between the desert of Shur, Israel, and Egypt. And Beer Lahairoy, they don't know exactly where it was, but it's somewhere around the Wadi Al-Arish on that borderline there. So that's where he was. But that was further to the south and west, so you had to go north a little bit and east to get to Gerar. Chapter 26, verses 2 through 6 of Genesis. The Lord appeared to Isaac and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and to your descendants I will give all these lands. And I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and will give your descendants all these lands. And by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed." That should sound familiar. "Because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." So Isaac lived in Gerar. Now, how did the Lord appear to Isaac? Well, he could have appeared bodily as an angel of the Lord, but probably not. It could have been a vision, could have been a dream, we don't know. But Isaac had a direct word from God, "Do not go down to Egypt." Now remember, at Beer Lahairoy, he was right on the border of Egypt. It would have been very easy to go to Egypt, especially when you consider the fact that Egypt is somewhat sheltered from famine because of the Nile River. They don't need rain as much as everywhere else does. And also, Isaac had his father's example. When there was a famine at Hebron, Abraham went down to Egypt, and Isaac might have said, "Well, if like father, like son, maybe I should go to Egypt too." So there are lots of reasons that Isaac should go to Egypt, but God appeared to him and said, no, don't go the way that seems wise to your flesh. Do what I say. And Isaac obeyed like an obedient servant of God, just like Abraham obeyed when God told him to circumcise himself and all the men, his son Ishmael, and all the men in his family, all in his household, all the servants, all the slaves. He said, "Circumcise them." Abraham got up the next day and did it. Abraham was an obedient guy too, and so was Isaac. Like father, like son. So God told Isaac to stay in this land. Now, of course, that's not immediately clear what land God is talking about. It could be Gerar, as Gill and Clark say, or it could be any other part of Canaan, the promised land. It just depends on how specific you think God is talking. But it doesn't really matter because Gerar was a part of Canaan, the promised land. The idea is, hey, staying in the land, this is what I promised you. I want to give you this land. I want you to stay here. I don't want you to get seduced by going somewhere else. You go down to Egypt, you might like it so much, you end up staying down there. And then what happens to my covenant promise to give you the land? Abraham and his descendants the land. And so as an incentive to get Isaac to stay in Canaan, he says, "I will be with you and bless you." Well, that "with you" is an interesting phrase. It's a very common promise in the scriptures. Now, think about it. If you got God with you, I mean, who can be against you? If God is with me, who can be against me? If God is for me, who can be against me? God is with you. I mean, that means he's watching over you. He's going to bless you. He's going to take care of you. In Genesis 26:24, we read this. Well, that's the verse I just read. Excuse me. Genesis 28:15. "Behold, I am with you, Jacob." This is Isaac's son, Jacob. "I am with you and will keep you wherever you go. And I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you." So when God is with you, that means he'll keep you and he won't leave you. Genesis 31:3. "Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you." Joshua 1:5. "No man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you." So if God is with you, you're not going to fail. You're not going to be forsaken. You're going to be blessed. You're going to be kept. Isaiah 41:10, do not fear, for I am with you. This is referring to the nation of Israel. I'm with you, the nation of Israel. Do not anxiously look about you, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Surely I will help you. Surely I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Jeremiah 1:8, do not be afraid of them, for I am with you to deliver you, declares the Lord, to deliver Jeremiah. Jeremiah 1:19, they will fight against you, but they will not overcome you, for I am with you to deliver you. So if God's with you, he will deliver you. Matthew 28:20, this is Jesus teaching them to observe all that I command you, all that I commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Jesus is with the disciples even to the end of the Jewish age, which ended in AD 70. Acts 18:10, for I am with you, and no man will attack you in order to harm you, for I have many people in this city. That's referring to what the Lord said to Paul in a night vision in Corinth. So I like that phrase, God is with you. God will be with Isaac if he'll just obey and stay in Gerar. Now in verse 3, God promises to give to Isaac and his descendants all these lands, plural. That would refer to the different lands that belong to the different Canaanite tribes, which makes it plural. Notice how all three of the elements of God's promise to Abraham are in verse 4. Remember, God promised Abraham land, offspring, and blessing. I always think about Abraham standing on a tennis court, and he lobs the ball over the net. Land, offspring, and blessing. Now notice here in verse 4, we have all three of the promises repeated to Isaac, the son of Abraham. I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven. There's your offspring. I will give your descendants all these lands. There's a land. It's a little bit out of order. Offspring first, then lands. And by your descendants, all the nation of the earth shall be blessed. There's the blessings to all the nations of the earth. And of course, that's fulfilled. That was fulfilled physically in the descendants of Israel and the kingdom of Israel, the land, the offspring, the blessings to all the nations, because Israel was a leader in the ancient Near East then, and spiritually it was fulfilled in the Christian church, where believers, whether Jew or Gentiles, believed in Jesus, and they became the children of Abraham, spiritually. Now here's an interesting little phrase in verse 5. It brings up a theological issue. Well, let's back up a little bit, pick it up in verse 4. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and I will give your descendants all these lands, and by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge. So in other words, were all these blessings, land, offspring, and blessings, were they contingent upon Abraham obeying God? Well, if so, that makes Abraham's covenant conditional. And we know that most people say that Abraham's covenant is unconditional. I say most people, but not all. There are some reformed people who like to get into this. John Piper says that this verse right here proves that the covenant was conditional. However, God sovereignly causes those conditions to be met as he influences human beings to obey the covenant so that it will be obeyed in that mysterious interaction between human free will and God's sovereignty. Well, that's an interesting piece of theology, but it does look sort of conditional here, because Abraham obeyed me. I tend to say that Abraham's covenant was unconditional, and what God is just doing here is just saying, look, Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, and so because of that, I'm going to give him land, offspring, and blessings. He's not saying that the covenant is conditional or not. He's saying Abraham in his past did that. The conditions were kept, but even if they hadn't been kept, the covenant still would have happened, because it was unconditional, as we look in Genesis 15 and see that it was a one-sided unilateral covenant. Although some people split out unilateral and conditional, it's a complicated issue. And I'm not sure I have the answer to this, because that verse sure does make it look conditional, but I don't believe it. I believe Abraham's covenant was unconditional. Because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. Now there's four legal terms: charge, commandments, statutes, and laws. Translation might be a little bit different. That was the Holman Christian Study Bible. Excuse me, that was the New American Standard Bible. There are other possible translations for those legal terms. Statutes can be translated as decrees in the NIV. A charge could be translated as requirements in the NIV. Doesn't really matter. The NIV Study Bible says that all these four terms, charge, commandments, statutes, and laws, this is legal language describing various aspects of divine regulations, and I don't think the distinctions between them are all that important. There are distinctions in Leviticus 26, 14, and 15, but if you do not obey me and do not carry out all these commandments, if instead you reject my statutes, and if your soul abhors my ordinances, so we have commandments, statutes, and ordinances. Well, maybe it's a distinction. I haven't figured out what the distinction is. I don't think it's all that important in my humble opinion. Now, verse 6 says, Isaac lived in Gerar. Well, that shows that he's obedient because that's what God told him to do. Don't go to Egypt. So Isaac lived in Gerar. So, therefore, because God told me not to go to Egypt, so, therefore, I, Isaac, lived in Gerar. Now, in verse 3, God says to Isaac, I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. What oath was that? Well, we read about this oath in Genesis 22, 16 through 18. By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son. This is when Abraham didn't kill Isaac, only offered up Isaac as a virtual sacrifice on Mount Moriah. Because of this, there's another, by the way, there's another because, which makes it look like the condition, the covenant is conditional, not unconditional. But I'm not going to get into that. Because you have done this thing, indeed, I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of your enemies, and your seed, all the nations of the earth, shall be blessed. So there's your land, offspring, and blessing. And notice this, by myself, I have sworn. So there's the oath. That's the oath that God is referring to as he speaks to Isaac here in Genesis 26. We go now to Genesis 26, verses 7 and 8. When the men of the place asked about his wife, he said, that's Isaac, said, she is my sister, for he was afraid to say my wife, thinking the men of the place might kill me on account of Rebekah, for she is beautiful. It came about when he had been there a long time that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out through a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was caressing his wife Rebekah. Well, this is the sister gambit. Abraham did it twice, like father, like son. Question is, why would Isaac follow Abraham in his father's sin? Here's some options to answer that question. Option number one, Abraham never told Isaac what Abraham had done. He might have been too ashamed to tell him, so Isaac might not have realized he was following in his father's footsteps. Or option number two, he might have known, Abraham might have told him, but Isaac didn't consider what his father did was a sin. And maybe Abraham didn't consider it a sin either. And so therefore he imitated Abraham's actions. In good conscience, after all, it had worked twice for Abraham. Why would it not work for him? Now, we need to point out some distinctions here. When Abraham did it twice, once in Egypt and once at the same place. Different Abimelech, probably a different king, but it was in Gerar. When Abraham did it, he committed a half-truth because he said that Sarah was his sister, which is true. Sarah was a half-sister. However, a half-truth told with intent to deceive is a lie, so I don't think that gets Abraham off the hook. However, I would like to say, as I argued in a previous audio, that Abraham might not have been to blame in this situation. Now, when he was in Egypt, for example, he had three options to protect Sarah. He had left Canaan, left Hebron, because there was a famine. He goes down to Egypt. He had three options to protect Sarah. He could go back to Canaan to get her away from the lustful Egyptians. Well, that means that Sarah would starve, as everybody else would in Canaan. That's not a good option. Option number two, he could have told the truth. Yes, she's my wife. And likely Sarah would have been taken from him. He had no police force. He had no embassy he could go to. He had no court system he could go to. He had nobody that could help him. He was helpless as an alien and a stranger. Option number three, the option he took, he could let her hide out in Pharaoh's harem and say, well, I'm going to keep Sarah with me and hope nobody comes to get her, but if Pharaoh figures out who she is, well, she'll go to the harem once. I guess he knew that Pharaoh had figured out who she was when he came to get her. He didn't reveal Sarah's true status. And he might have thought, well, if she's in Pharaoh's harem, it takes about a year for Pharaoh to get around to having sexual relations with the harem members. And so maybe in a year's time, I can figure a way to get her out. I don't know. But all the commentators say that Abraham was sinning when he did that. But I just have trouble to blame old Father Abraham. But that's not quite the same thing here with Isaac, because Isaac lied straight out. Rebekah was only his cousin. As John Gill says, she was not his sister. And plus, this subterfuge might have been somewhat premature, in my opinion. Notice that Abimelech seems to think that a wife status would have protected Rebekah. And a few verses later, he says in Genesis 26:10, then Abimelech said, what is this you've done to us? One of the people could easily have slept with your wife, and you would have brought guilt on us. Well, that implies that if people had known that Rebecca was the wife of Isaac, they wouldn't have slept with her. But since they didn't know, they would sleep with her. And so maybe Isaac was just a little bit, maybe he jumped the gun in his prophylactic actions to protect his wife. However, the people of Abimelech were scumbuckets. They stole Abraham's wells, stopped them up, and then they did the same thing to Isaac's wells, as we will see. So I'm not sure how moral these people were. So again, I'm a little bit hesitant to blame Isaac for what he did. And notice that Rebekah didn't end up in a harem. He took a gamble and lost. When I say Isaac took a gamble and lost, what I mean is he gambled that his wife would be protected by him calling her his sister, and he lost that gamble when he was caught caressing his alleged sister and the gig was up. But if he hadn't have done that, he might have gotten away with it, and so lying might have been a reasonable thing to protect his wife. He says, she's my sister, and hopefully people would lay off of her. That didn't work, but you know, hindsight's 20/20. So was that a lie that was justified in self-defense? I tend to think so. But I'm not a Jesuit. I'm not a moral casuist. I can't judge these things with the mind of God, but I think people ought to be careful about just automatically condemning Abraham and Isaac for what they were doing in a hard situation. Hard cases make bad law. Now, remember, like, how he found out was he saw Isaac and Rebekah caressing in verse 8. Now, Adam Clark points out that it was actually unclear exactly what Isaac and Rebekah were doing because the word is hard to translate. But whatever it was, only a man and wife would be doing it. The word in Hebrew is a form of the word to laugh, another pun on Isaac's name. Isaac and Rebekah were laughing or caressing. Maybe they were just talking to each other in a way that brothers and sisters don't do. I mean, husbands and wives do not converse the way that brothers and sisters do. So however it was, Abimelech found out about it. Genesis 26, 9 and 10. Then Abimelech called Isaac and said, "Behold, certainly she is your wife. How then did you say she is my sister?" And Isaac said to him, "Because I said I might die on account of her." Abimelech said, "What is this you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us." Now the might there, one of the people might easily have done, that's clear. It shows that nobody did it, including Abimelech. So that means Rebekah's honor was preserved. Now that's important because we need to know that the lineage of a seed of Abraham is legitimate as it runs from Abraham to Jesus. We don't want any bastards in the line. Now, this was a problem with Sarah because she went into the harem, and we don't know that she didn't have sex with the Pharaoh. We just assume. We don't know. However, there's no problem as far as the legitimacy of Isaac because when she went into the harem, she came out, and it was years later before she had Isaac. So it was very obvious Abraham was the father and not the Pharaoh. She was barren long after her stint in Pharaoh's harem, so the legitimacy of the seed is not in question. And here, Rebekah's virtue is not in question either, because from what Abimelech says. Now, Abimelech is worried about guilt being brought upon the people of Gerar because somebody might have taken another man's wife, Isaac's wife. What kind of guilt? Well, John Gill speculates there's two options. Option number one, that Abimelech didn't want to be guilty by interfering with the purity of the descendants of promise. He might have, by that time, have known about God's promise to Abraham. It might have gotten noised about the land, and he might have heard about it, and he didn't want to get in the way of that. I don't think so. I just think the other option, option number two, is correct. Abimelech considered adultery to be a grievous and destructive crime, which most people, maybe not in the United States of Sodom and Gomorrah, but most people consider adultery to be very, very bad. So that's probably what he was worried about. We go now to verses 11, 12, and 13 in Genesis 26. So Abimelech charged all the people, saying, "He who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." Now Isaac sowed in that land and reaped in the same year 100-fold, and the Lord blessed him. And the man became rich and continued to grow richer until he became very wealthy. Now, isn't that interesting? If Isaac sinned in what he did in lying about the status of his wife, Rebekah, God sure didn't punish him for it. Nowhere does it say he did anything wrong. In fact, he was protected by the king of Gerar, death penalty for anybody who touches him, and then he got rich. Sure doesn't sound like he sinned. Sure didn't seem like he had a lack of faith. He's rewarded for it, just like Abraham was. Abraham, the two times that he went, Sarah ends up in the harem in Egypt and Gerar. Both times, Abraham and Sarah walked out with lots of wealth, twice. So I take this to be examples of God's extraordinary grace towards his covenant people. Now, that doesn't prove that they didn't sin. It could just be a matter of grace. You sin, but I'm going to bless you anyway. Grace. God can always exercise grace. Or it could mean that maybe Abraham and Isaac didn't do anything wrong. I won't take a strong stand on that, but I just want you to think about that a little bit. Now, Isaac became rich. He sowed. He planted. He was not just a nomad shepherd. He also planted crops. And notice that there's a famine going on where Isaac used to be, which is either Beer Haleroy, maybe Beersheba. Famine there, but prosperity there. What's a good application for this? God can not only take care of, but he can prosper you in the most adverse economy. We need to remember that, because who knows when the next crash is coming. Now, Isaac reaped 100-fold. There's an option as to how you take that word 100-fold. You could take it literally, or you could take it proverbially, so that 100-fold meant a whole bunch. Either way, doesn't matter. Isaac was rich, as it says explicitly in verse 13. Isaac started out rich by inheriting Abraham's wealth, because Abraham was wealth and right of primogeniture, which Isaac wasn't the oldest son, but he bought the birthright from Esau, if you recall, with a mess of pottage, a red lentil stew. And so Isaac started out wealthy, and now he's getting richer by the minute. Now, I would say that this is a warning to those Christians who say poverty is necessarily a sign of spirituality, like in all the Middle Ages. Oh, he's so holy, he's poor. Well, let me tell you something. Abraham and Isaac certainly weren't socialist. They were blessed by God. If you think why socialism is so anti-Christ and so anti-God, God will bless his people. He'll give them creativity. He'll give them discipline. He'll keep them from wasting their money on mistresses and drugs, and he'll do a lot of good things for people. And so naturally, those type of people naturally will end up with more money than those that don't. So then other people look at that and say, oh, it's not fair. They got more money than me. I want it. And so they vote for socialist. Now, this is not to endorse the other extreme, which is the hyper-faith prosperity movement, which is an abomination to God, an abomination to the human race. We go to Genesis 26, verses 14, 15, and 16. For he had possessions of flocks, this is Isaac, possessions of flocks and herds and a great household, so that the Philistines envied him. Remember, the Philistines, that's an anachronistic term. It means the people of Gerar. The Philistines didn't end up there until 400 years later. Now, all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham his father, the Philistines stopped up by filling them with earth. Then Abimelech said to Isaac, go away from us, for you are too powerful for us. Now notice that the Philistines envied him, just what I just finished saying. People make money, and people who don't have the discipline or the luck or the talent or the hard drive, the work ethic or the drive to get wealthy, they get jealous. And that's what happened here in Gerar. That's what less well-off people tend to do when they see people of wealth. They tend to be envious. Instead of producing new wells and new wealth, the people of Gerar attack the wealth of someone else. Despite the fact that Isaac's wealth was legitimately earned. In other words, socialism sucks. Now, verse 15 refers to all the wells which Isaac's father, that's Abraham, Isaac's father's servants, had dug in the days of Abraham his father. Now, we've already talked about the previous sojourn that Abraham had in Gerar. Now, the question is why did Isaac expect to use those wells? And that's one question. Another question is, why did the Philistines stop them up? You could say that the wells were abandoned and Isaac had no claim to them, so they had every right to stop them up. Well, why would they stop up a well instead of using the well? Not only that, Abraham had made a covenant about one well with Abimelech's father, assuming that it's a different Abimelech. We read that in Genesis 21, 25 through 31. But Abraham complained to Abimelech because the well of water which the servants of Abimelech had seized. Well, actually, they didn't stop it up. They seized it. They stole it from him. And Abimelech said, I do not know who has done this thing. You did not tell me, nor did I hear of it until today. Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them made a covenant. Then Abraham set seven ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. Abimelech said to Abraham, what do these seven ewe lambs mean, which you have set by themselves? He said, Abraham, you shall take these 7 ewe lambs from my hand so that it may be a witness to me that I dug this well. Now, this well to me is ambiguous. It either means the well that they were standing there at Beersheba, or it meant the well that was stolen from Abraham. But at any rate, they signed a covenant. They signed a treaty, Abimelech and Abraham. So you would wonder why the people of Gerar had filled up Abraham's well. It might not have been the same well that they had made the deal over, but still, they'd made a covenant, made a treaty, and so you would think that would be friendly and they wouldn't be stopping Abraham's wells up. All right, so that's the first problem, and I think I would answer that by saying, well, maybe the covenant didn't pass down to Abraham's descendants, or people just forgot what the covenant was, or maybe they just broke the covenant and they said, we're going to stop up Abraham's wells, because I'm going to assume that Isaac had inherited those wells and was using them, and Isaac had gotten so wealthy and so powerful that the people of Gerar, because of the envy, they just started stopping them up. So I'm going to assume the wells belonged to Abraham, passed down to Isaac. And I think the reason that the people of Gerar stopped those wells up rather than using them is because they wanted Isaac to get out of Dodge. They were fighting Isaac's power. They wanted him to leave. In verse 16, Abimelech said to Isaac, go away from us, for you are too powerful for us. And that sort of illustrates my point. Abimelech is either commanding him to go, or he's suggesting that he goes and is trying to explain why the wells were filled up because of Isaac's power. The Philistines were getting upset about it, or the proto-Philistines were getting upset about it, wanted Isaac to go. Now, Abimelech could have two possible motives here. One, he could be giving Isaac advice. He says, look, I love you, Isaac, but the people of my realm are getting real upset with you. Maybe you better get out of town for your own safety. Or it could be he was angry with him too and wanted him to get out and says, leave, Isaac, leave. We don't know. We go to Genesis 26, verses 17 and 18. And Isaac departed from there and camped in the valley of Gerar. Now, that is not the same place as Gerar. That's someplace close by called the valley of Gerar. Probably wasn't under the command of the king. Well, it might have been, might not have been under the command of the king of Gerar, Abimelech. So Isaac goes there, the valley of Gerar, and settled there. Verse 18, then Isaac dug again the wells of water which had been dug in the days of his father Abraham, for the Philistines had stopped them up after the death of Abraham, and he gave them the same names which his father had given them. So these people were encroaching upon Isaac's inheritance, upon his wells. Remember, wells were very valuable for an arid landscape where there was very little water. You had to have wells, like a gold mine. Well, Isaac dug them back up, and the rule was, you dig a well, you repair it, it's yours. So he dug it up. That means he had legal title to it. He gave the same names which his father had given them. You give a name to a well, it becomes well known in the community. It's like having a deed to it, sort of. Lets everybody know who owns the well. Now notice in verse 17, Isaac departed from there. There was a dispute over the well in Gerar. The people of Gerar had filled them up, and Isaac left. Whatever legal claims to the wells there in Gerar he had, he obviously didn't feel was worth fighting over, and so he left. He departed, verse 17. Of course, he had the same problem when he got down to the valley of Gerar. His father Abraham's wells were stopped up there, but he dug those, but he left. He didn't fight in Gerar. This accords with Isaac's calm and peaceable nature. Remember, he was a mama's boy growing up. I say that somewhat tongue-in-cheek. He liked to hang around the tents, if you recall. Esau liked to hunt or plant and go out in the fields. Jacob liked to stay in the tent, and she became close to his mama, Rebekah. Now, when Isaac goes away from Gerar to the valley of Gerar, it's obviously he didn't go very far because he had more quarrels with the men of Gerar in verses 20 and 21, which we'll read about later. Now, these wells of water, which had been dug in the days of his father Abraham that Isaac redug, they could have been the wells that were previously mentioned in Gerar as opposed to the valley of Gerar. And so, therefore, he dug those wells back up in Gerar, but that cuts against what I just said, that he just left to avoid the conflict. So I'm going to assume that it was wells in the valley of Gerar, new wells that Abraham used to have, and he dug those up. Now, these wells in the valley of Gerar that the inhabitants there had stopped up after the death of Abraham, why did they do that? Probably to keep Isaac from using them. There was no reason to fill those wells up. They could have used the wells themselves. But I suspect they were trying to counteract Isaac's power, trying to get him to leave. Why did he name the wells? Well, he could have done it out of respect to his father Abraham in order to preserve his memory, or could it be to make the title to his wells more clear and certain? We go to Genesis 26, 19 and 20. But when Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found there a well of flowing water, The herdsman of Gerar quarreled with the herdsman of Isaac, saying, "The water is ours." So he named the well Esek, because they contended with him. Esek means dispute or contention. And this is digging in the valley. This is the valley of Gerar, which is off a little ways from Gerar proper. Now, this might be a new well, or it might be a well that was redug that used to belong to Abraham. I'm not sure. But anyway, they found flowing water. The Hebrew for that is living water, which is a common metaphor for the effects of the Spirit of God, the water that brings life, because physically water brings life too. And so they had a fight over the well, because in arid landscapes, that's what happens. We go to Genesis 21 and 22, and we'll finish up this audio. Genesis 26, 21 and 22. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over it too. So he named it Sitnah. Sitnah means opposition, as the NIV note says. Gill translates it as hatred. This word Satan has as his name, and these men were of a diabolical spirit, envious, spiteful, and malicious. I wouldn't doubt that. Sitnah, opposition. I guess that sounds like Satan. I guess that's why Gill says it's diabolical. Verse 22, he, Isaac, moved away from there and dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it, so he named it Rehoboth. For he said, at last the Lord has made room for us and we'll be fruitful in the land. Rehoboth means room, according to the NIV note, and that's why Isaac said, we've got some room now, we're not fighting anymore. Now notice how this dispute was solved. Verse 22, Isaac moved away from there, further away from the border of Gerar, where the men of Gerar would have less claim. Now, Adam Clark says about this, never did any man more implicitly follow the divine command, resist not evil, than Isaac. Whenever he found that his work was likely to be a subject of strife and contention, he gave place and rather chose to suffer wrong than to have his own peace of mind disturbed. Thus, he overcame evil with good, just like Abraham did with Lot. Instead of fighting with Lot, he said, Lot, take whichever land you want. I'm not going to fight you. So, this illustrates the point that sometimes it's better to fold them than it is to hold them. Sometimes it's better to walk away and sometimes to run, as Kenny Rogers and the Gambler said. Sometimes if you can, it's better to move away from strife than to participate in it. And I know sometimes you can't avoid it, but if you can, retreat to the wall. Nothing worse than strife. Let them call you a coward. Of course, sometimes you got to act like a man and stand up and fight. I realize that. There's some people that just want to fight over everything, and something, it's just not worth it. Now, if it's your life, or if it's something that you need to stand up for, you need to stand up for. Paul stood up for stuff. He stood up for people all the time. So there's nothing wrong with standing up against heretics and standing up for the purity of your church or whatever. But if it's over a well, you might want to let it go. Of course, that takes wisdom, the wisdom that only comes from the Holy Spirit of God. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Genesis chapter 26, verses 21 through 22. Our next audio will cover chapter 26, verses 23 through 35, and it will concern Isaac's treaty with Abimelech of Gerar. We'll take that up in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.